We're going to try and get through some information this evening. I've already told several of you that we may not be able to get through the end of this, but we'll get through what we can in a reasonable manner. So we've been going through the Gospels, looking at the 11 events that are kind of crossover, that are mentioned in all the different Gospels, compiling them and seeing what we can learn from each individual instance that it's mentioned. We're going to be looking at the betrayal, as is up on the screen this evening, and so we'll be starting there. We kind of just briefly mentioned these passages, and I'm sure you guys all did your homework and read all of these, just like I asked you to. Silence is very reassuring. So here we have those passages. And again, all of them there. We're going to start by talking about what they all mention. They all mention Judas as the betrayer. So he's famous for that. Nobody really names their children this name. You know, that's not something you want, not on the top 10 list of names. So he's mentioned as the betrayer. All of them mention the multitude of people that came out for the arrest. All of them mention Peter drawing the sword. So there's where these are all in every one of these cases. Now as we move on to Matthew's account, we begin seeing what he kind of emphasizes. He emphasizes, "Friend, do you do what you've come for? Friend, answer your cell phone." So in Matthew, when Judas comes, right? Judas comes up to Jesus. What does Judas do? He betrays him with a kiss, which is a greeting as a friend. And we've seen this even in our studies before in Samuel. This is a greeting that's been around for ages and ages. You know, it was a common greeting of friendship. And he uses that thing, that same symbol as friendship, as a way to betray Jesus. Why the kiss? Why was that necessary? Yes, sir. Exactly. I mean, they didn't have posters up around all the place in the post office about who Jesus was. You know, they didn't know who he was. So this was, as was mentioned, to identify who Jesus was. Then we have Jesus saying in Matthew's account, "Take up the sword and you will die by the sword," in verse 52. And he also mentions more than 12 legions of angels in verse 53. He says, "Or do you not think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he'll at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels." And so Matthew mentions that, whereas the others do not. And then we have this verse 54, that this is done to fulfill the scriptures. This has to happen, Peter. Let it happen. This has to happen. And we'll talk more about that later on. So these are things that Matthew brings out. Of course, he's going to talk about fulfilling the scriptures because he's writing this letter to a Jewish audience, right? And so he's going to talk about those kind of things in his message. If we go over to Mark in general is a little more abbreviated in what he has. Mark tells us in verse 43, Matthew kind of gives us this information as well, but they came with swords and clubs out to Jesus. And we'll see that mentioned again in another, in Luke's account. Every day I was with you, in verse 49. Look in verse 49. What is Jesus saying in this situation? I was with you every day. Why is he saying that? In verse 49, Mark 14. Yeah, you could have arrested me like at any point, guys. You know, why are you waiting until now? I'm up here praying and you're just, you know, you're interrupting my prayer time. Why are you waiting until now? So, you know, they've had various opportunities to do this. Verse 52 is interesting. Why is it interesting? Well, yes. It doesn't give his name. I mean, yeah. If you're writing, we're going to leave out who that was, right? Maybe it was John. He never likes to get mentioned in any of the Gospels. He left fleeing naked Yes. Anyway, that's all the comment we'll have on. But Mark mentions that. The other ones do not. And so at least, what are we showing? Why are we showing? Why is he fleeing in such haste? They might arrest him, right? They might arrest him. Jesus even asked, and we'll see this in the other account, please let these guys go. And so he escapes. And then we look at Luke's account. And Luke emphasizes, it's much more abbreviated than others. And he kind of mentions, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? In verse 48. He looks and shows Peter asking, should we use the swords now? Can we use the swords now? In verse 49, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Because remember earlier he had told them what? In Matthew's account, he had told them that they needed to have what? Swords. Swords. He said, take swords for the defense of the gospel. And then he said, here we have two. And he said, that's good enough. So that's why, you know, one in six people is allowed to have a sword. So they had enough. And so at this point, Peter says, should we strike? Is this the moment that we get to use the swords? Right? And so this is... and what's interesting also is if you compiled all of how this went down, Jesus in verse 41 answered and said, stop, because he had cut off, Peter cut off the priest's or the servant of the priest's ear. And if you compiled Jesus' comments about what happened with Malchus, if you compiled all these things, this would be the first thing. So the ear is cut off. And I don't know if it was laying off to the side or is like OFF on the ground, but the ear is cut off and Jesus yells, stop. No more of this. Why? If you cut my friend's ear off, I'm going to cut yours off, right? That's just how it goes. And so Jesus says, stop. We're not going to do this. This is not what we're going to do. So he stops this and then tells about living by the sword, dying by the sword, and all these other comments that he makes. But he stops that from happening, and he heals the ear. And so there's no harm, no foul kind of situation here. You have the ear back, and you know everything's good as new. We can go on to the next phase of what's going to happen that night. And he also says this phrase in verse 53 to those who are arresting him. He says, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours. So rather ominous statement, right? But kind of talking about who they were working for at that point, right? They weren't working for God. John 18, 2 through 11, John emphasizes Judas knew where they were going to go. They had been there before. This was his habit to go to this place. He knew the place. John tells us he knew where to go. John also talks about the Romans were involved in verse 3. We don't get that from the other accounts, but in this situation, the Roman cohort was involved. They come out at Jesus with lanterns and torches in verse 53 and weapons. And so, again, we kind of talked about how topography of this situation, we basically have two hills, and they could have seen, especially with torches, and the Roman cohort, if it's a... The Roman wore sandals with metal studs on the bottom of them. So if you've ever, worn shoes with metal studs ever, probably not. But they make a lot of noise on rock. So you have a Roman cohort coming out. You can hear them marching. You can see their torches. This is not stealth mode scenario. Okay, so they could see what's going on. Jesus even says, look, the hour's come. They're coming to get me. He asks them, who do you seek? Right? And verse 4. And we have this situation where they asked, who do you seek? And they answered in verse 5, Jesus the Nazarene. And he said to them, I am he. And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When therefore he said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. The other accounts don't give us this information. We don't know exactly what's happening here. But again, they ask. And so we have this back and forth kind of, who do you seek? I am he. kind of dialogue. And then we get, let these go their way, as we mentioned earlier in verse 8. And because he says that he did not lose one of his disciples. The slave of the high priest is given a name here in verse 10. Is Malchus, which this will come around later on. We'll talk about this guy. And also, he talks about verse 11, that he needs to drink this cup. Jesus therefore said to Peter, "Put the sword into the sheath. The cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" What was he praying in the garden about a cup? Let it pass, but if it be your will, not my will, but yours will be done. And he says, I need to do this thing for the Father. What was it that Peter said, or Peter did, that inspired Jesus to say to Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan"? Do you remember in Matthew 16, 22 and 23? What was it that Peter said then? You're not going to die, right? You're not going to die. Because Jesus just told him, Son of Man's got to die. And Peter said the same exact thing, sort of that, or same sentiment that the devil said in the garden, "Surely you shall not die." And Jesus' response was, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Peter still here in this moment isn't on the page of Jesus dying. He's not on that page, even in this moment. But Jesus says to him, "I've got to drink this cup. I've got to do it." And so in this betrayal, we learn these, and you put all these facts together, it becomes much more vivid, this arrest that takes place on the hill. Now, after the betrayal, we can go into some lessons from the betrayal. Of course, talking about Judas' love of money. We can talk about the meekness of the Savior and him surrendering. When you think of meekness, what do we normally think of? Weakness, right? So he could call how many legions of angels? That's not weakness, right? That's not weakness. 12 legions of angels is not weakness. As has always been stated, meekness is power under control. And so that is exactly what is displayed here. Of course, we have the misuse of the sword. I need to click it here. And he didn't lose one of the disciples, but one of them lost him. Do you understand what I'm saying? He didn't lose any of the disciples, but one of them lost him. If it would have been known in the foresight of God, he would have prophesied that Judas would have come back. Was Judas ever to the point where he could not have come back? No. Peter also denied Christ. It was God knew that it was going to happen and prophesied as such. So these are some lessons. There's obviously others, but these are some lessons from the betrayal. Now, we go into Peter's denial, and if you read the accounts, they have the trial begins, sort of the kangaroo court trial begins shortly after this, and then they go to the denial, and there's some other aspects of the trial. That is something that is in all four Gospels. We do not have time to go through how the trial unfolds in all four Gospels, so we'll do this event with Peter's denial. Here we have all of the passages, and then what we can learn from all of them. All of them mention being in the courtyard, talking about the sort of the structure of the house where they were. All of them mention the questioning by the servant girl. All of them mention the denials by Peter. All of them mention the rooster crowing. So these are all things that are mentioned, but there's other details that they don't all have in there. Matthew, in his account, gives us Jesus is mentioned as a Galilean. There's a lot of mention about him being from Galilee, or a lot of his ministry that was done in Galilee. And Matthew specifically mentions Jesus the Galilean, as the servant girl said to Peter. The bystanders were also questioning Peter. So when you start reading through these accounts, you'll start seeing there's questions coming from various different places, not just the servant girl. And so there were other people who were there in the courtyard who were asking Peter or saying, "Hey, I think you are one of those guys." And so they all mentioned that. They say that his speech actually gives him away. How he spoke gave him away. The fact that, oh yeah, you're from that region. You have to be one of those guys. And then, of course, that he wept bitterly. Luke mentions this as well. But he went away and wept bitterly. Is there a difference between weeping and weeping bitterly? Yes. Yes, there is. And Peter, I think that was a low for him in his life. But as we go on to Luke, or Mark rather, we have this below in the courtyard. Why would that matter? So they're in the courtyard, and then below in the courtyard. Why does that matter? It's just a minute detail. It's like green grass. But why does that matter? We're talking about different levels, right? So the house was higher. There was an elevated portion of the house where Jesus may have been under trial. They are warming themselves by the fire in verse 67. Verse 68 is interesting. He says, but he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you're talking about. That's what you want to do if you're going to deny something, right? I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even hablo Hebrew, right? So I don't even know what you're talking about, is how he's sort of trying to deny the fact about what's going on. I'm just here warming myself by the fire. This isn't my fight, right? Verse 69, it says the servant girl is kind of stirring things up. The servant girl saw him and began once more to say to the bystanders, this is one of them. He's one. Yep, he's one of them. And so she's kind of keeping this conversation going during all of this. And then Luke mentions or emphasizes that Peter came following at a distance. Talks about the location being in the fire, being in the courtyard. Again, just kind of painting a picture for us of the scenario. Verse 56, the servant girl was looking at Peter intently. Some of you have been looked at intently. This may be Greek for the evil eye, right? What she kind of was, you know, eyeing him, knowing about what was, that this was certainly one of Jesus' person, people, disciples. We get a time stamp with Luke. In verse 59, it says, after about an hour had passed, another man began insisting, saying, certainly this man also was one of them, for he is a Galilean also. So they're not there for like 20 minutes. They're there for a while. So all this time, the trial, this mock trial that Jesus is undergoing is happening upstairs within earshot of Peter. They can hear him questioning Jesus. They can hear him mocking him. They can hear him slapping him. And so it is not like he's so removed from the scenario that he doesn't know what's going on with this mock trial with Jesus. But they were there for a long period of time. And we have this in verse 60. Peter said to the man, I don't know what you're talking about. And Luke says, while the words are coming out of his mouth, the rooster crows. You had just told hours before this guy that you've been following around for years that I'll never leave you, that I'll never forsake you. You had just said, is it time to draw the sword? And a servant girl and her band of people call you out, just asking if you belong to him, right? And you deny him. Three times you deny him. And you say, that's never going to happen. He just told you hours before this that this was going to happen. Do you think, like, after he said it the first time, that, no, I don't even know who this guy is, that it would come to his mind, oh, wait a second, if they ask me a second time, I can't say no. So you'd think that would kind of, but it didn't. He was caught up in the moment. He's caught up in the scenario, caught up in the implications of being named among one of Jesus' followers. And so have you ever been in a situation where you've just been caught up in the moment and done things you said you weren't going to do? Anybody? Some of you are not. Some of you are honest. But anyway, so you know, it happens. It happens. And so it happened with Peter. Of course, verse 61, I think, is probably the most poignant part on all of this. When the rooster crowed, what did Jesus do? Turned and looked at Peter. Oh, that would hurt. That would be worse than anything, right? That would be so. You had just told the man that you were never going to deny him, and he turns and looks at you the moment the rooster crows. He turns and looks at you. You know when parents say, "I'm so disappointed in you," and you just feel like you're this big and you want to crawl in the carpet? This would be worse than that, even. Worse than that in relationship to the magnitude of the situation. And so no wonder that we get here Luke also recording that he went out and wept bitterly. So John, striving to be different, gives us some different information. He kind of breaks it up in that he starts this process and then gives us kind of what's going on upstairs with Jesus and then comes back down to Peter. And so we have this break in between the passages. So another disciple was with Peter, verse 15, that we didn't know about that prior. The disciple that helped Peter get into Caiaphas' house knew Caiaphas, knew the high priest. And so he was allowed to let Peter in. The slave girl that we've been talking about was the gatekeeper. So again, we're getting more and more information about this scenario. She saw him as he came in, and so she's been eyeing him the whole night. The slaves and officers were around the fire as well. So they're all standing. Why are you standing around a fire? Why would you stand around a fire? Because it was cold. It was cold. It was like 65 degrees or something. It was frigid out there. So they had to warm up around. You guys can relate to that, right? So they had to warm up around the fire. And then one of the slaves that was questioning him was also related to Malchus in verse 26. So one of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Wait a second. Awkward moment, right? No, that wasn't me. That was another one of the disciples. So he was there. He saw Peter. So he obviously denied it again. So here is the events that happened with John or Peter's denial in all four occasions. Some lessons that we can maybe learn. Does the way you talk show you to be a follower of Jesus of Nazareth? That was what betrayed him, right? Hey, you talk just like him. Yeah, you got his mannerisms and everything. Does your speech betray you to be a follower of Christ? And then, do we deny Christ with our actions? I'm not saying that you outright say, I'm not a Christian. But in our actions, the things we do, do we get caught up in the moment and deny Christ by the very things that we say we would never do, and we do them ourselves? Which I need to push this button for you to see that. And then Jesus always sees. Right? Is there any moment when you're just like, I'm by myself, nobody knows what I'm doing? No. Jesus always sees. So maybe that'll help us in our motivation. There's other lessons we can learn, obviously, from that, but time is failing us. So the crucifixion, of course, this is going to be mentioned in all of them. They all mention that he was led out to the place of the skull. They all mention the instance with Jesus being named King of the Jews. They all mention that he was crucified between two thieves. That they cast lots for his garments, that the comments from the crowds, the naysaying of the crowd, those are all mentioned in all of these different accounts. Now, as we unfold this and get more information about each individual one, we have, of course, the accusation of being the Son of God is mentioned, highlighted in Matthew. So this is a blasphemous thing, verse 43, that he's the Son of God. It's no wonder that he would mention that in relationship to a letter Matthew writing to a Jewish audience. And so they get the gravity of maybe the situation in that case. We also have the events that accompany the crucifixion, verses 51 through 53 in Matthew's account, are highlighted more here than they are in any other ones. And it says in verse 51, "And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rock were split." This was mentioned in some of the other ones, but the other ones don't talk about the tombs that were opened, and the bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised, and coming out of their tombs after his resurrection, they entered into the holy city and appeared to many. So these things were not mentioned in the other accounts. One thing that's interesting in relationship to all these things happening, a centurion says what in relationship to Jesus? Truly, this was the Son of God. Verse 54 says it became very frightened because of all things that happened. And a centurion, which was, you know, the tough of the tough guys, says truly this was the Son of God. And so that's a very, very good commentary on the situation. Mark also mentions that as well. If we go on to Mark's account, we see the emphasis on Simon of Cyrene. It was pressed into service in Mark chapter 15. But we get more information here in Mark's account when he talks about this. Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear the cross. Who are Alexander and Rufus? Do you know who they are? I have no idea who that is. Nobody knows really who that is. David, do we know who that is? We don't know who that is. But do you think the people who received the letter knew who Alexander and Rufus might have been? Do you think maybe helping carrying the cross of Jesus changed the life of Simon of Cyrene when he saw the events that unfolded? And it's possible that his children became Christians because of it. He and his household possibly became Christians because of it. And when this letter was written, the people who received this letter possibly knew Alexander and Rufus. So that is something that we get here in Mark's account that we don't get in the others. It was the third hour when he was crucified, in verse 25, a detail that is left out in the others as far as the time when he was crucified. This phrase, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, is mentioned here. It's mentioned in Matthew as well. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Mentioned in Matthew, Mark's accounts. And so that this is something that we want to highlight out of Mark's account. And then the presence, The presence of the women and disciples from a distance. And at the end of this section of Scripture, in verse 40 and 41, they mentioned the presence of the women and some of the disciples from Galilee that were there at a distance, observing the events that were unfolding. And Matthew kind of mentions that as well. Luke, as we go hurriedly along to Luke, we have the presence of the multitude. Mentions it twice, the presence of the multitude. And just this was no small thing. It's not like they were crucifying just some random people. These are twice he mentions this, the magnitude of the people that were involved in this. He mentions the situation with the daughters of Jerusalem in verses 28 through 31, where Jesus speaks to those who are grieving for him. He says, "But Jesus, turning to them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, unto the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green tree, what will they happen in the dry?" So what is Jesus talking about? It kind of alludes to what he mentioned in Matthew 24 in relationship to the destruction of Jerusalem. So even in the situation where he is heavily burdened, he is burdened with this cross beam that he's having to carry. He's been flogged and mocked and ridiculed. He's been up all night. At that moment, he's still prophesying and concerned about the welfare of others. And so that's quite a big lesson, especially in verse 34 where he says, "Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." This had an impact on a disciple's life, Stephen, Stephen kind of echoes the same sentiment, right? Whenever he was stoned in Acts. And then the dialogue with the thieves is recorded here with Luke. And so verses 39 through 43 talks about this dialogue and what they were saying to him. One was mocking him and one was saying, hey, we deserve this. But he doesn't. Remember me when you go into your kingdom. In verse 43, truly I say to you today, you shall be with me in paradise. Something that's taken out of context once or twice. But we don't have time to dive into that tonight. And then this phrase, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. Luke gives us that phrase as well. And then surely this man was innocent. In verse 47, the statement again of the centurion. After seeing all the events, he said, this guy has got to be innocent. He surely didn't do what they're claiming he did. And then those from Galilee, many of people from Galilee were there as well. So we go on to John, and we're getting through this faster than I thought. This is amazing. John emphasizes that he went out bearing his own cross. He doesn't mention Simon of Cyrene. Is that a contradiction? No, it's not. Because he did go out starting bearing his own cross. He doesn't mention that Simon of Cyrene, you know, somewhere along the way had to finish that process, had to help him finish that. There was dispute about the sign. Do you remember what was written in verse 19? And Pilate wrote an inscription also and put it on the cross, and it was written, Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. Therefore, the description of many of the Jews read in the place Jesus was crucified was near the city. It was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. And the Jews kind of come to Pilate and said, hey, don't write that. We don't like that. That's bad PR. We don't like what you're saying. And Pilate's response was, what I have written, I have written. You know, that's what parents say to children around. That's universal. What I've done, I've done. The decision I've made, I've made. What I've written, I have written. And so he mentions that. John gives us this, woman, behold your son, in kind of taking care of his mother. Behold, I thirst. I'm thirsty, verse 28. And then the phrase, it is finished, in verse 30. So there's some phrases that John gives us that are not mentioned in the other accounts as we go through those. And then they also mention the Sabbath law in connection with why the body had to come down so quickly. And then also the pierced side is mentioned here. And then the scripture might be fulfilled in relationship to not a bone being broken. So all these things John gives us in his account that we don't see in the other accounts, but you put them all together, again, it paints a more vivid picture of the crucifixion and the effects on those who are witnesses of the crucifixion. Just people who were witnesses of the crucifixion said, surely this is the Son of God, just seeing the events that unfolded. And we're not talking about people who went around and followed Jesus all the time, just people who were there to witness the event. It changed their opinions of who Jesus was. And so putting all these together helps us see why maybe some of that information, why that would be the case. Of course, lessons from the crucifixion, there are a myriad, the cost of sin, the love of God, and on and on. We could talk about some other ones as well. I just realized that was really small. I didn't change that. Anyway, sorry. The burial. We got 5 minutes maybe? 5 minutes? Oz is saying yes, 5 minutes. In the burial of Jesus, they all mention the role of Joseph. Not Joseph, the father of Jesus. Joseph, a rich man from Arimathea. They all mention binding Jesus in linen. They all mention the timing of the burial as the day before the Sabbath, and so the urgency to get Jesus buried. So these are all things that coincide and are mentioned in all the accounts. In Matthew's account, he emphasizes that Joseph was a rich man. And so that accounts for him having this tomb. The concern that the body was going to be taken, it was mentioned, and the next day, some of the people, the Pharisees, come up to the Romans and say, "Hey, you need to make sure that that body doesn't go anywhere." Right? And verses 61 through 66, or 62 through 66, make sure the body doesn't go anywhere. And Pilate's response is, make it as secure as you know how. Make it as secure as you know how. So they put a guard on it, they seal it physically with a seal so to know if it's been opened or not, and they put this heavy stone in place. And so they seal it as well as they could so that nobody would come and take the body. Of course, they knew what had been prophesied. And then we have the, in Mark's account, Joseph was a prominent member of the council, that he had to gather up courage and was waiting also on the kingdom. And so this, again, we get, as we go through each account, we get more and more information about who this Joseph of Arimathea is. And so we get this from Mark's account. Pilate was wondering if he was dead already. When Joseph came to ask for the body, Pilate was wondering, is it so soon? Is he dead already? He had to concur with some of the other soldiers that, is he dead? And they're like, yeah, he's gone. And so only after then would they give the body to Joseph. And so seemingly, Pilate thought it was going to last longer than it did. We have this, again, account of Mary, two Marys, Mary Magdalene, and then another Mary there who were concerned about where Jesus is going to be laid, and they'll obviously play a part in the resurrection. And then only Mark leaves out the fact that it was a new tomb. Every other account mentions that it was a new tomb, and Mark leaves that out. Luke gives us information concerning Joseph was a good and righteous guy. We have information about that he had not consorted with the council in their plan to arrest Jesus. Joseph was on the council, the guys that decided what to do with this guy. What are we going to do with him? And so he said that he was not with them. We get the origin of where Mary's, where the two Marys were from, and they arrested him. In verse 56, they rested according to the commandment. They obeyed the things of the Old Testament. John, very quickly, Joseph was a secret disciple. Look in John chapter 19. Why is Joseph a secret disciple? Yeah, he was kind of like amongst the inner circles, the inner circle of people who were kind of putting all this together to kill Jesus. And he didn't let them know that he was sort of on Team Jesus. He did not consent to how they were practicing and what they were doing, but he was secret. And it says here he was a secret one for fear of the Jews. And then we have another guy who was involved in the other secret disciple in verse 39, and Nicodemus came also, who had first come to him by night. So it's not just any Nicodemus, it's the Nicodemus that we see in John chapter 3. Sorry. Blank there for a second. So we have these two secret disciples who are kind of there helping. Nicodemus brought the spices, and talking about the custom of the Jews as far as the burial is concerned. And we also get this new tomb that was in the garden, and the tomb was nearby. So this, all these things kind of talk about the burial process, and we don't have time to go into how all that actually took place. Why is the burial important? We have eyewitnesses of the accounts of the burial. We have eyewitness people who were there to witness that the body was buried. Not just disciples, but Romans, who could care less about what was going on, also were witnesses to these things. And so it's not like it was any secret thing. And then, of course, the Bible talks about the likeness of baptism in relationship to the burial as well. And then the most important aspect of all, the resurrection. And here we go. The events that unfolded with the resurrection. They all mentioned it was the first day of the week. Is that significant in any way? Just a wee bit. They all mentioned that. They all mentioned Mary Magdalene coming out to the grave, and they all mentioned an empty tomb. Is that important? Only slightly, right? An empty tomb is extremely important in relationship to all of this, and so of course they all mention that. When we go over to Matthew, Matthew's going to emphasize that the events happened the events that happened with the guards, why the guards were kind of subdued, and the angel saying, I know that you've come looking for Jesus, and then also that same angel saying, go tell the disciples quickly, go tell them what's going on. Mark, in his account, is going to give us information in relationship to who will roll away the stone. The ladies are walking up to the tomb. So they're coming up to the tomb to kind of deal with the body, and they have this. They know that when they get there, they have this huge stone that's in the way from them doing that, and they talk about, well, who's going to move that stone? And so that's a normal conversation you'd have, right? In verse 6, they have an angel saying, here's a place where they laid him, and then we have this in verse 7 in Mark's account. It says, go tell the disciples and Peter. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Why and Peter?
Betrayal.
The betrayal. He may be still weeping bitterly over the betrayal and all that took place there. Now, what's interesting, of the 12, he appeared to Peter first. Of the 12 disciples, Jesus appeared to Peter first. 1 Corinthians 15:5 tells us that. And, of course, that's also significant in relationship to the life of Peter. And verse 8 tells us that, like any normal red-blooded human being, they ran from the tomb in fear. So, you know, it's not normal you see angels or angels in that scenario. And Luke tells us more about, of course, that there were two men or angels. So if all the other accounts mention one angel, and then Luke says there were two, is that a contradiction? Why is that not a contradiction? They could be there at different times. But they have mentioned just the one that was speaking, right? They didn't mention the silent partner that was over there, you know, good cop, bad cop. They didn't mention the other guy. They just mentioned the one angel. So if there's two, then there's one, right? So it's fine. It's not a contradiction. Luke talks about, why do you seek the living amongst the dead? Reminded them of the teaching. And so these are things that Luke emphasizes, as well as the names of the women are given. The apostles, of course, thought it was... Go back so you can read that, maybe. There, okay. The apostles thought it was nonsense, didn't really believe what was going on at the time. So we didn't get through all of it. The bell has tolled, and we must come to an end of our class. If you want copies of these notes, I can get them to you. Send me an email, and I will respond with copies of these notes. Thank you very much for your time. I hope it's been beneficial in putting all these events. So we put all 11 events that are in all four Gospels together and painting a picture of these core events in the life of Jesus. Thank you very much for your time.